First Peter chapter 3. We've been in a series talking about marital love. I want to continue that today. Just going to read together two verses. First Peter chapter 3 verses 6 and 7. I'm reading from the New King James Version of the Bible. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Husbands likewise, dwell with them with understanding, is what the New King James says. I like the word knowledge. We'll return to that in a moment. Giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. It's interesting, in this passage, he talks first to the up above, to servants in verse 18, be submissive to your masters. Wives in chapter 3, verse 1, be submissive to your husbands. And then he says, husbands, on your part, this is what I want you to do. Paul dealing with the basic relationships of the society of their day. We don't have it to be true, but in their day, relationships between servants, slaves, we would call them, and masters, were just as important as husbands and wives. At that time, the Roman Empire was based upon a slavery system. The ratio was something like 16 to 1, slaves to free men. And so we read these things, and it's a little out of proportion to fit our day and age. What I want to do today is, we've been talking about marital love, I want to zero in on a particular problem that has always been and will continue to be a barrier between a husband and wife and the full expression of love and marital love and human intimacy. It has to do with a woman's fears. It's interesting, in this passage, as he talks to women, he says in chapter 3 and verse 1, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if they do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. And so he'll begin to talk about what that is. What is the chaste conduct, and what is the fear of God that must accompany it? But he wants them to understand that fear he's talking about in their submission to their husbands is not a fear of their husbands, is not a fearfulness about the world, is not a timidity and a apprehensiveness and a nervousness about the world in which they live. When he says in verse 2, chaste conduct accompanied by fear, he's talking about being a God-fearing person. Because in verse 6 he said, just like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham, even called him Lord, whose daughters you are. You follow her in her faithful activity. If you do good, chaste conduct, and are not afraid with terror, are not startled, are not easily concerned, are not living with these fears. I think what Peter is doing is putting his finger on something that through millennia has been a problem for women. That's the problem of fear. Women live in a different situation than men live in this world. We marry people who are different than us, not only in gender, but who have really grown up in a different society. Men grow up in one kind of society, women in another. Not only are we ill-suited to see things the way other people see things because of our gender, we're also ill-suited because a man's world and a woman's world in every culture are different. And one thing about a woman's world is that there's a much greater level of insecurity there than for men. Women have always had that pressure put upon them, have always had that added burden to overcome. Women are much more insecure because even in today's supposedly equal opportunity environment, they don't make as much as men, they don't have the same job opportunities as men. A woman who is on her own, even in those days, was in great trouble. A widow needed to be provided for. Women have to fear many things in our society today because of what has happened. We are children of what was called the sexual revolution. We are children of what was called feminism. What that did is it divorced the American male from any responsibility to look at a woman and to treat her with honor and respect. While it was supposed to liberate the woman and liberate people, we find that what it did is gave license to human beings to commit all kinds of sins, to act and to treat women with the greatest disrespect. Even now, when the very president of our nation has been on a 6-year sexual harassment suit, these are things that we have to think about. And women have to fear this area. When women have to fear for their physical safety to walk the streets at night, this hasn't been so in every society for every age of the world. When women have to fear sexual assault, when women have to fear sexual harassment, women have to wonder, how do I project myself to the world? How can I dress in such a way that's appropriate and not be accused of encouraging something? Men never have to think that way. I've never worried about my dress encouraging somebody to think some way about me, other than the fact of, well, you should have washed that tie before you wore it. Men, we don't live with these kinds of problems. And so we often look at a woman and her insecurities and think, well, that's their makeup. That's the sick world that we live in. And to some degree, that's the sick world that males have made it. And the Bible addresses those concerns. Paul was living in a day and age, and we'll see what he has to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Peter was living in a day and age. We'll see what he has to say. And we're going to go back to the Song of Solomon and see the insecure situation of the woman of that book and how that's a love story about overcoming her insecurities. And again, it's not because of her frail, weak, feminine makeup that's insecure. It is life that put her in that situation. And it is the society of their day that put her there. And that's why much greater attention and honor needed to be given to her. Notice what he says to husbands. Husbands, dwell with them with knowledge. I don't like the King James word understanding, because we understand, and I tried to point out to you, the word knowledge has definite connotations in the Bible, especially between husbands and wives. When it says Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived, it doesn't mean that he got her address and phone number. It doesn't mean that he became acquainted with her. And this word knowledge always between husband and wife has that connotation. And he's saying, dwell with them. That means stay with them. That means cohabit with them. That means live as husband and wife so that that woman doesn't have to worry about you taking off. We have this strange system today whereby people live with one another apart from marriage and think nothing of it. I don't know how that comes about, that people think that gives you more security. Trial marriages, and we'll try this on and we'll try that on. I want to tell you, it's not a coincidence that while the rate of that has gone up, the rate of divorce has skyrocketed as well. That is no coincidence that we see those two patterns. It is now true that 2 out of every 3 children born in America are born illegitimately. The world has changed since we were, my generation was in high school. Illegitimacy was something that was really a concern. Today, it is the norm. It is the norm. In certain portions of our society, in the black inner city, Jesse Jackson, for all of the things where I might not agree with him, puts his finger on some real problems. He said the greatest problem facing African Americans today is immorality and illegitimacy. 7 out of 8 children born to African Americans are born illegitimately. How can we build a society when that's true? He said. He's right. But it's the women who pay the price. When it comes to these things where our society has changed, it is the woman who will constantly be the one who pays the price. You would never have thought that some boyfriend would have run out and shot his girlfriend because she broke up with him. Today, women have to think about that. These are tremendous fears and concerns. And Peter, the Holy Spirit, directs him to address these concerns. Husbands, live with your wives. Dwell with them. According to knowledge, which means an intimate, complete understanding of who they are and of what their situation is. I will freely admit that even though we joke about it, it is still true. It is very rare to find a young man who will understand how women think or how women work. We joke about it because it is true. But it doesn't mean that it's not supposed to be a goal. It doesn't mean that it's not supposed to be something you work at. When we have a society where the men feel that this world is for them, of them, and about them. Where everything you see on TV, where everything that is done, where everything in the world is for and about the males, that's turning the world upside down on its head. And he says, you husbands, dwell with your wives with understanding, with knowledge, being intimately aware of the problems they face, of the world that they are entering, of the concerns that they have. It's very, very difficult to come into a marriage with two people who are supposed to be complements and not opposites. You're not supposed to think like your partner. They have a thinking that is supposed to be different and to complement yours. What you need, they provide. The two of you together interlock to form one complete way of thinking that will build a family. And yet here, I think he focuses on the husband's need to say, what's your role in that? Will you dwell with them with understanding? So many times, pastors are confronted with couples who have problems with being intimate with one another. Many times outside the church, and until the present generation, people wouldn't talk about it. 40 years ago, nobody would come to their pastor and talk about it. And the pastor had to wait until he saw the problem cropping up in other areas of their lives before he could deal with it. Today, if it's a benefit, is that people are more open to deal with their problems and they want to talk about it. They see that these things are not correct. And that's one reason why I'm addressing it from the pulpit. These are not simply human problems, they're spiritual problems. And they have to be addressed like every other problem through the Bible. Notice what he says, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. Our Sunday school class today was talking about the church. We constantly learn the rule in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. We give honor to the parts of the body that seem to be weaker, that are in a more vulnerable position. We cover them up because they are more vulnerable, not because they're weaker and to be despised. We didn't used to do it, but today you get in the shop and you start working around the shop or you start working in a wood shop and the first thing you learn to do is put on a pair of glasses. You might not think twice about it until you met somebody who lost an eye or lost their sight for any period of time. Those eyes are pretty vulnerable. That's why God covers them up. My hands aren't covered, but my eyelids are there to cover and protect my eyes. They're not to be despised, they're to be protected. And one of the things we have to understand is that the woman is the weaker vessel in large part because of the role that she has been put in society, because of the nature of the role that God has placed her in as being the help suited to man, and in part because of the fact that in all societies, sin weighs heavier on the woman than the man. It's the woman who bears so much of the brunt of sin, who pays so much of the consequences, while the men seem to skate off free and easy. And it's a terrible thing to see. And he says you're to dwell with them and to give them honor. I want to take you back to go from here to the book of Song of Solomon and to show you how part of that book is the lesson of how love between a man and a woman overcomes this kind of insecurity. Let's go back to Song of Solomon. I don't know whether you have ever studied this book. You ought to. It's a difficult book unless you have a Bible that will divide it up between the speakers. This is a book that's really like a play. Certain people are speaking in one part, certain people are speaking in another part. Very hard to tell from the English text. In Hebrew, it's a little easier because they have their verbs and their nouns tell you whether it's a man or a woman speaking or more than one. In English, it's very hard. So it's a little easier if you have that kind of a Bible. Basically, it is the story of two young people who are in love. Different approaches to this. As I understand it, she is a virgin who is part of the harem of Solomon. I don't believe Solomon is the lover in this. I believe he is the owner of the harem. And constantly she has someone with whom she was in love, maybe with whom she was betrothed, or maybe with whom she was married, even before she entered into Solomon's harem. He did that. So did his father David. took women as wives for other people's wives, enters into this harem, and now she longs for this lover. And constantly she says, I'm doing this and I'm doing this, and he says, Solomon has 180. And look at chapter 6 and verse 8, for instance. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. Solomon can't say that. Solomon's heart loved many women, we're told. This lover in here, I don't believe, is Solomon. It is someone that she loves, and she is in the position, very vulnerable position, of women in that day. They had no control, or virtually no legal control, over their destiny in marriage. A woman was in a very vulnerable position of having to, her legal position was that she could not sign a document without being married and her husband's permission or her father's permission. She could be given in marriage and have nothing to say about it. Now, we find that wasn't common, that in most cases the parents loved their children and worked with their children. In most cases the parents saw whom their children loved and worked. But it didn't have to be so. It didn't have to be so at all. And we find some women who were in some very vulnerable positions. Look at Ruth, who had to go back with her in-laws not even knowing. And she went, when Ruth went to that threshing floor at night, she had no idea what would happen to her. She was trusting God's grace. Look at Esther, had to enter the harem of the king of Persia. She had no idea what would happen to her. Women in the Bible found themselves in some very vulnerable positions. This woman did. She's in a harem of a king who doesn't know her and doesn't love her, and she's in love with something else. And I think that's what this book is all about. How is her love built up? She's a young maiden growing up. How is that something that can be fostered? How do you remove the insecurity? Well, I'm just going to start reading in Song of Solomon, verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine, because of the fragrance of your ointments. Your good name is ointment poured forth. Therefore the virgins love you. Take me away. See, she doesn't like being where she is. Take me out of here. I want to tell you that women are vulnerable for more than one reason, but in part, especially the young girls, because see her imagination here? She's thinking about him in the third person, and then it becomes the second person. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Your love is better than wine. It's true that I think, especially in the teenage years, girls are very romantic in their thinking. Guys are not. Guys think about girls, but it's usually not romance, and it's interspersed with baseball, football, soccer, other kinds of things. Girls think about relationships. Guys don't. Okay? It's whether it's the nature of our society or just the nature of the beast, probably us being the beast, whatever it is, she's very romantic in her thoughts. And notice what she thinks about him. It's so typical of a young girl, and especially in the era of David and Solomon. That's why the virgins love you. Remember one of the things that was most outstanding about David? Why Saul's daughter loved David? Because all the young girls sang his praises. All the young girls just loved David. And that's what made Michael, Saul's daughter, love David as well. And that's what eventually made her hate David. That same praise and glory. So she's there and she says, take me away. Whatever she's in, she doesn't like. As it develops in the book, we'll find out where she is. Notice what he says about her in verse 9. I'm skipping down to show you what her situation is. I have compared you, my love, to a filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Every woman likes being compared to a horse. That'll get you in good. You know what his point is? One of the things the Bible told Solomon, there were two things Solomon was told not to multiply. What were they? Wives and horses. Don't go down to Egypt for horses. He's saying, you know, you're in the harem, you're just like another horse that he owns. You're just like another filly. You're another possession. He multiplies both of them. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments. Your necks with chains of gold. Just like a horse. I don't know what the term you use when you caparisa and you ornament and decorate a horse up. When it says your cheeks are lovely with ornaments,
the horse, the mane that runs down beside its head, and they work the jewels into it. He says, you're just like one of those horses on the chariots, that he just wants to decorate you and ornament you, and that's all you are. You're stuck in the harem. The daughters of Jerusalem, the other members of the harem, say, yes, we will make you ornaments of gold and studs of silver. Oh, we'll do that for you. Here's a young girl that's suddenly thrust into the place of being in the harem, and her love is someplace else. By the way, very similar to Esther's situation, suddenly thrust within the situation of being in the harem of King Ahasuerus, and she has to decide, will I serve the God of my people or not? But that's what this is about, her position. And notice her concerns, okay? The king brought me into his chambers. The king is the one who took me into his harem. The daughters, we will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. All these other ladies and the chorus is saying, oh, you should love it here. It's a great honor to be here. You should just feel fine here. Notice in I'm going to come down to verse 5. She says, I am dark, but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard have I not kept. In every society across the face of the world, the lighter skins are the more desirable, because the lighter skins are those who haven't worked outside. If, for instance, you travel to Puerto Rico, you will not see the Puerto Rican ladies on the beach. They wear umbrellas. They shade themselves because the lighter skins are more desirable. It's a very unfortunate factor that black Americans have to deal with. There's a bias among black Americans that lighter skinned blacks are considered to be smarter or more whatever than darker skinned blacks. Very foolish connotation. But it's in the world. And the reason is, in societies, you work outside with the dark skin. How do you think we got the term redneck? You know what redneck comes from? From working outside. It's that idea of you're working and the sun catches you there and it doesn't catch you below your collar. Well, when you work outside, it's considered to be lower. The women who were in the palaces, they never stepped outside. They weren't in the sun. They didn't work. They were kept in this beautiful garden and put in this special place. Imprisoned there by the society that says this is your function as a woman to live in this garden. And part of this whole story is how her lover says, come out of that, leave that, and talks to her not about the city and its riches and the gardens and the walls, but about the wilderness. Let's get back to the way things are and about things natural. Every time there's a metaphor for their love, both spiritual and physical love is spoken of in here too, the metaphor is always about the wilderness, is always about those kinds of wild things. Well, that's the point. But notice her concern. Don't look at me. I can't be looked at. I don't want you staring at me. I don't like the way I look. And then notice, she says in verse 7, tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. She's talking to somebody who's not a king. She's talking to somebody who's a shepherd. For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? It's an interesting thing. The women who veiled themselves were the prostitutes at that time, especially this particular word. She's saying, it makes me nervous to pursue you. You tell me you love me, but I don't want to step out there. I don't want to put myself out front. I don't want to appear too aggressive. I don't want to look shameless. Men never have to worry about that, but women do. How am I going to appear to the man? How am I going to appear like I'm too aggressive? I got to appear modest and ladylike. What does he think modest and ladylike is? Is he thinking period? Well, these are concerns, and young men never get these. They don't understand that everything that goes on during the course of that date, she analyzes. What does he mean by that? What does he think about that? As you get older, the older women will tell you he probably didn't mean anything and wasn't thinking anything. But women go back and talk, what did he say? And he said, what do you think he meant by that? My wife will tell you, it's an apocryphal story but not true, that after our first date, I told her she was sick and should go home. That she looked sick and it was time for her to go home. I'm sure, to my way of thinking, I was trying to show concern. It was cold out that night. It was the middle of December.
And I was saying, well, you better get inside and bundle up. And it came across to her and her friends like, oh, great, you know, you look, you got the bubonic plague, you know, on our date, stay away from me. Well, there are these differences in talking, but it's very, very hard for a man without using the Bible and maturity for an insight to say, this woman has something to overcome. I want her to be attractive to me. I want to praise her for these things, but she needs my feedback. She needs to be able to grow out of her insecurities about the way she looks, about her presenting herself. She needs to hear from me that I'm beautiful. She needs to hear from me that I'm desirable. She needs to hear from me that I'm attractive. It's just as true today in your marriage as it was back here. And by the way, why do you think most of the rest of the books is him praising her for her looks? It's not as if looks are everything, but it's an area where she at the very beginning is very insecure. And he has to bring her out of that. And he says, I see your situation. You were chosen and you're just part of the harem. And he doesn't love you. I really love you. I think you're beautiful. In verse 15, he says, you are fair, my love. You are fair. You have a dove's eyes. She says, you're handsome, my beloved, and pleasant. Our bed is verdant. The beams of our houses are cedar and rafters of fir. I am the rose of Sharon. I am the lily of the valley. That's her response because she's confident in his attraction to her, his love for her, his acceptance of her. I think that's a great key in the Old and the New Testament. A woman has to be confident in her husband's love, in the fact that he finds her attractive. It's not that looks are everything, but that's an area where women very much are insecure. You never see a bunch of men saying, does this outfit make me look fat? Tell me. You know, I don't see the ushers getting back to me saying, what do you think? These pants, they do it for me? I look back, men don't do that kind of thing. You take us as we are. We put on a little weight, more of me to love. We take a little less weight off, I must eat. Men don't care. I tell you this for a fact. We lose our hair. We might joke about it, but it ain't no real big deal to us. Men don't have this concern, but we have to understand that women do. Women do care about how they look. Not to an unspiritual degree, but it's the job of the one who loves them, of that man that God has given to them, to build them up and to say, I find you attractive, I find you beautiful, I find you desirable. To set them free to be who and what they are. To recognize the insecurity of the position that they have been placed in by the nature of the world and by the nature of our relationship. We have a relationship where we believe as Bible taught people that the man should be the leader and the head. That means that the woman is put automatically into the role of responder. That's a tough role to be in when you have to respond. That means you've got to read that person. That means he's got to give you something to respond to. How many women find themselves in a relationship with a man who is unresponsive? Who doesn't communicate, well, that's just me. I don't care what's just you, it's what I need in a husband. Love doesn't foster in those situations. That's not her insecurity and her feminine problem. It's your failure to fulfill the role of a lover, to make her feel secure and wanted and attractive and needed. Come back with me to where we started in Peter. Husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor to the wife, as to the weaker vessel, being heirs together of the grace of life. Equal, joint heirs. You're both supposed to be equal sharers in the inheritance of life. I'm not sure what I would get if I took a poll of the women of most Baptist churches, if they thought that they were equal sharers in the bounty of the church and of the blessings of life. I trust that I would find, and I believe I would in this church, find godly women who say, I like what God's given to me. I like who I am. But if you ask them, do you feel it's been equal? That you've gotten an equal share of the bounties and the privileges and the pleasures and the grace of life living with your husband, living in your family. I wonder how many women would say, yeah, it's equal. If it's not equal, why not? Why aren't we expecting them to take pleasure out of the marriage the same way we expect to take pleasure? Why isn't it our role as husbands to please as well as to be pleased? I'm talking in the possessions you own. I'm talking the decisions you make. I'm talking the intimate relationships. That's what it's all about. And it says we're heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Don't you think that you can have a partnership where the husband is not that lover who gives security and that your prayers won't be hindered? Don't think that there won't be spiritual consequences for marital failure. Don't put them into two camps. Well, that's that part of my life. It doesn't work that way. I'll tell you something. If you can't love and be intimate with that person who you see physically every day, who's right there sitting next to you today, what makes you think that you can love and be intimate with Jesus Christ, whom you've never seen? How can you say that I love the Lord when you can't be in love and love the person that you're next to? How can you be close to the Lord when you can't be close to the person who shares everything in this life with you, good or bad, whether they know it or not? Tell me how that's going to work. It doesn't. You're kidding yourselves. He says that your prayers be not hindered. The very same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He said, don't defraud one another. Don't rob your partner of what they need and what they desire and what they have a right to by being married to you. Don't defraud each other. That's what this is all about. We're in a sex man society, and I don't want the church to get caught up in that kind of nonsense. I want us to get back to what the Bible says about human marital relationships. And it has a lot to say, has a lot to teach us. I want us to understand what God expects of us as human beings, how God has made us, and that this is His design for us. And we better have something positive to tell our kids, because they're getting the negative out there, and all they're hearing from us is silence. They're getting pounded by negative images, and all they hear from us is silence. What do they infer from that? We've got something to teach, and we should be teaching it. Let's pray. Oh, Father, I thank You for Your Word and its truth. Cause us to be a church where Jesus Christ is exalted in every part of our lives, in the public part and in the private part. Father, in our praise, worship, and in our prayers, in the things that we do openly and the things that we do behind closed doors, I ask that You might not only bless us, Father, but You might change us. If there's any heart here that's not right in this area today, anyone who's in pain and hurting, may they see that the love and the grace that You bring to change lives will affect that part of their life too. I pray that You might make us as men, lovers and communicators, givers of protection and security, not dominant, not arrogant, not thinking ourselves the unequal partner. And I pray, Father, that what we are and what we have will be to the glory and praise of Your Son. It's in His name we pray. Amen.